I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are and where we come from. So who are you and where do you come from?
I'm Arlene Bailey. I'm from Salins in County Kildare and I'm a singer.
Arlene, thanks for coming tonight. Thanks for driving up. As I said, I have a few issues with Skype. It just doesn't want to be my friend. So thanks for coming up to me.
It's no problem. Thanks so much for opening your door to me. I could be Jack the Ripper.
I know. Do you know, this is someone the other day wanted to meet me and Paul was like, "You're not meeting him. Do you understand that?" He was like, "You can do a Zoom." But I just was like, "Oh, yeah." I was like, "Yeah, I'll meet you for coffee." Paul was like, "No, you won't."
Yeah, I think the internet makes the world seem like a much more smaller and kind of safer place, nearly, in one sense, you know. So yeah, we're kind of, oh yeah, he's my friend, she's my friend. You don't know who you could be dealing with.
Yeah, so but I won't be doing that. And I didn't. I didn't. So
that's, and I'm fine. I'm not Jack the Ripper.
Arlene, tell me, you reached out to me on Instagram and then we had a little conversation back and forth. But from the start, you want to tell me about your life in Salins and then where that took you.
Yeah. Born and bred, shall we say, in Salins. I had a normal and lovely upbringing, I guess. I was painfully shy as a child. I think there was stages where I wouldn't look at people even that were related to me. I didn't even want to talk to them. And then other times I'd be jazz hands. I could be up on the table doing a jig for you. There was very little in between. And it's only recently that I noticed that to be kind of similar to the way I am now and maybe a trait of my condition. But so great childhood, mum and dad. I have an older sister, younger brother. A lot of love and a lot of laughter in that house, there always was. I knew from day one that I wanted to sing. I always wanted to sing. There was no stopping me. I had a plan, and by hook or by crook, I was going to set out and do what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a professional singer. So my parents saw this in me as well and used to encourage me. I was going to say push, but a bit of both. So they would be kind of on my case, sing this, sing that, get up and sing with this band, do this, do the other, you know, put yourself out there. And then at 16 years of age, I joined a band. It was unheard of for anyone in our house to leave school before finishing secondary school and doing your leaving cert. But I upped and left. It was like joining the circus. Sayonara, good luck, everybody. As soon as I turned 17, I left. And as I said, I was with a band then. We hit England. We travelled around England.
For a second, yeah. The band, who were they? Like, were they older? Were they, you know, at 16 years of age?
Yeah, they were older. It was an all-girl band. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, look, that's light years ago now at this point. But anyway, we travelled. Yeah, we did a fair bit. As I said, I did 9 weeks, the first stint away from home. First time ever leaving the country, and of course out into the big bad world without mammy and daddy. It was a shock to the system, but a real eye-opener as well, Rebecca. Like, I think I probably needed that kickstart, needed that slap into reality. I think at the time it was unhealthy in one way, but also I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't change. If I could go back now, and even when I relive certain experiences, I think, would I change that? No, I wouldn't, because that's what's made me who I am today, and I'm where I am today for that reason or those reasons. But
what type of experiences were they? Were they, you said, unhealthy? What was so
unhealthy? If I go back to, say, when I was 15, I was really withdrawn, and I used to have really dark thoughts, and I didn't know why. And I have discussed this now publicly on a couple of occasions, so I don't mind saying it, but I took an overdose when I was 15 years of age. And I was very cool and calm about it. I just decided, yeah, I'm going to do this now. I don't really want to be here anymore. And it was very kind of, it was an easy thing to do for me at the time, which is insane. You'd imagine that you'd be, I don't know what way I should have been. But in my head, I probably thought, wouldn't I be completely off the scale, insane, lost the plot? No, I was very rational about it. And being 15 and being a bit of a gobshite, pardon my French, I told my friend, and she nursed me all night. She didn't take me to the hospital. We didn't tell my parents. We didn't tell anybody. We happened to be babysitting that night, or she was babysitting and I was with her, which, you know, was fine. Wasn't anything out of the ordinary, because we both would have babysat on different occasions for this same family. So I spent most of the night with my head down the toilet, her holding my hair back. I remember her sitting at the table with me going, stay awake, stay awake. Like, I don't know why. Of course, maybe I know now why I did it. But at the time, I was like, what was going on? There was nothing going on with me. There was nothing out of the ordinary. There was no major heartbreak. There was nothing going on at home. You know, as I said, my childhood was idyllic. I had the best parents. Nothing. So I guess then when I set off at that young age of 17, I probably wasn't, well, I wasn't mentally in a great place. I just didn't really realise. So as time goes on, I suppose there would have been serious dips in my mood. There would have been times where I battled with food-related issues, like I would have starved myself. My weight dropped a ridiculous, like, I think at one point I was like a size 4. Yeah, I was all over the place. And all the while I was travelling the world. So I, at times, was surrounded by people I didn't like, didn't want to be around. I was homesick, desperately homesick. And I thought maybe that would have got easier as time went on. It actually got worse. Like, and even when I'd go away for short trips, like if I came home, I'd never really be home for any more than 4 or 5 days. And then I could be gone for 6 months. But if I came home for a number of days and went away for 2 weeks, for some reason, that even seemed worse than 6 months. I think once you hit a certain point when you're away from home and you're homesick, you just power through. It's sort of, I think you just become used to it or something. I don't know, I did. But yeah, so there was a lot of, no week was ever the same, basically. I spent a lot of time in the UK. I did several stints in the Middle East. I travelled all around the continent. I found myself randomly working in Monte Carlo Country Club, you know, with the finest of like the glitterati, you know, performing for people like that, and maybe going out that night and sleeping in a shitty caravan. Like on my I could write a book. I don't think I'd be able to do it justice if I sat down here for an hour with you and tried to explain what life was like on the road. But there was a lot of fun. There was a lot of heartache. There was a lot of brilliant times, a lot of great gigs there where, so I spent time in the States and I would have performed there to brilliant audiences, huge audiences, small audiences, pubs, clubs, whatever, you name it. I'd show up at the opening of an envelope just to do a gig. And yeah, there was some great times. I made decent money at times from the music business. And there was other times I went hungry. Like, I actually remember one time, I laugh now, but being so broke somewhere in France and having to get like cheap frozen chips and cook them up, and the cheapest of Coke.
Yeah.
And it was like fine dining at the time. Do you know, it's hilarious because I've experienced all ends of the, you know, the spectrum in that regard. But a lot of them are funny stories. Like, I found myself on a fishing boat off the coast of Saudi Arabia one time at 4 o'clock in the morning.
How?
Yeah, exactly. No one ever says that to me. They always just go, oh, that's great. That's hilarious. How? I was with a band. We were doing, what was it? It was 3 months. 3 months in Bahrain in a hotel. In Manama, which is the capital of Bahrain, and like that's literally just off the coast of Saudi Arabia. So I found the people out there, although you'd be kind of nervous because you didn't have a clue who you were dealing with, they were quite friendly and quite willing to show us around. Oh, come here, we'll show you the island and get into the back of our car and we'll bring you here. And we'd be like, really? The people were lovely for the most part. I didn't really experience anything nasty out there. But yeah, just some random guy who said, look, this is, let's bring you out here after your gig, we'll have a meal after your gig, and say it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and then this idea of the fishing boat, let's bring you out there and show you around. It's just outlandish. But actually, on the note of the Middle East, at the time, as I said, that at that point I was with the all-girl band, and we used to wear hot pants on stage.
Yeah, I'm about to ask that question.
So it would have been, like, it was a country band. And it was a brilliant lineup insofar as all the girls played their own instruments. It wasn't like a, you know, it wasn't like a teeny bopper type thing. Legitimate musicians and whatnot. But I looked out into the audience one night and there was a guy in his full Arab attire. I don't know the correct term for the outfit. And let's put it to you this way, he was having a good time with himself, you know, sitting there watching us. And I thought, how come nobody's stopping this? But no, nobody was going to stop him. No one was going to stop that man, you know, having a good time, as I said, in front of a group of women in hot pants. No, it's a man's world, isn't it? You know, especially out there. But I went solo eventually. I spent time in the States. Somewhere along the line, I got engaged to my childhood sweetheart. And
again, how, like, does he still in Ireland? Is he?
He was. He was my first proper boyfriend, and through all this, I guess he was always at the back of my mind, you know. So we lost contact for a long time because I was traveling, he was doing his thing, I'd come home, we'd get together, we wouldn't, it was on off from the age of like 15 or whatever. But bit of a whirlwind situation there. We got together and then we were engaged, we had the wedding planned, and then we broke up. And I packed my bags and went to New York, and he packed his bags and went somewhere else in the world. But so
did that affect you?
Absolutely, of course it did. The long story short there with that is we eventually got back together and married and then divorced after 5 years. So all the while, I know it's all part of my story, I guess, you know. It's not really the main story, but all the while this was going on, there was a mental health issue going on at the back of it. And do you know, I was a ticking time bomb, I think, in a lot of ways, because I was running around the world and I was wired to the moon at times and severely depressed at other times, and didn't realize that I was bipolar. So there was a lot of ups and downs. There was a lot of downs. There was a lot of times where I'd find myself curled up on the floor. Now again, I was homesick, so I'd put it down to that, or I was kind of miserable, or I just didn't want to be wherever I was at the time. But I remember being curled up on the floor, sobbing my heart out, going like, "This isn't normal. There's nothing really that I can pinpoint that's going on. No one has." Been murdered. Nobody has, you know, hadn't been dealt any terrible blows along the way as such that would have rendered me that depressed.
In that time, though, did anyone ever ask what was going on? Like, was there minders? Was there, you know, is there people watching out for you? Was your bandmates, did they not ask questions?
I'm tempted to say no comment on that one, you know.
That's okay. That's okay.
You know, I think there's a reason that certain people come into your life, and then there's a reason they leave as well, you know, or that you want them to. But no, and I think as well as that, if I go back to when I was 15, I'm there with my best friend. We're both 15 years of age. I've taken an overdose. There was no adult. There was nobody there to kind of watch over. They were there, but I mean, I didn't tell them. So, you know, there was no sensible grown up looking at that situation going, we need to get her to the hospital, or this girl needs to speak to somebody, or needs to, you know, whatever it might be, need counselling. And I guess at that time, no, there was nobody really looking out for me. I was looking out for me, Rebecca.
It's a different life, isn't it? My brother, he went to the Curragh at 11. He went, right. Just went to the Curragh. He was sent off there. So it's, I think, nowadays, I don't think anyone would let their 16, 17-year-old head off without
some... No, they
some,
wouldn't. You know, it's some, mad. Yeah, like, or, 11 is a baby.
Yeah.
And I think of my nephew, he turned 16 2 weeks ago, and I said to my sister, like, I was his age and then a little bit more, and I upped and left. Can you imagine letting him out of the town he lives in? Never mind letting him out of the country. You know, it is, it's... I don't know. She reckons that my mum and dad were mad to let me go. I don't think they were. I think they wouldn't have got a minute's peace if they didn't let me go, because I was, you know, I get a notion in my head and I'm going with it, and that's just it, you know. But
did you ever get yourself into a situation while you were travelling that you thought, I'm in big trouble here?
In what way?
Just when you were travelling around, like you're saying, you found yourself in a fishing boat. Did you find yourself in other situations that you were just like, or aside to that, in your mind, when you're curled up into a ball, is there a point that you're like, I'm in trouble with my, like, in my mind, I'm in trouble?
Yeah, I guess I didn't actually feel any kind of external danger, as you say, when you're talking about the fishing boat situation. That was more outlandish than anything else. But yeah, there was times I didn't trust myself. Do you know, there was another incident there where I sat on the floor in my bedroom in the house I was renting in Manchester. Now, I had cleaned the entire house because my take on it was, right, I don't want to be here anymore. And if my parents have to come from Ireland to my house now, if I do something drastic, I want the place to be clean. And that's just mad, I know.
It's the Irish in us.
Isn't it? Yeah, clean the house now and then just, you know, it'll be grand if anyone has to come in and step over a dead body. God forbid.
Arlene.
No, sorry for getting upset.
That's okay, take your time. Take your time.
That's where I was at, and that didn't work. Thank God, you know. And all these times, I guess I was crying out. It's that cry for help, whatever you want to call it. I didn't get the help. I went to...
take your time for a minute.
I went to A&E in a hospital in Manchester. I didn't see this coming. Damn you.
I know.
Or damn me, it's me talking, not That's you.
Right. Just take your time with it.
Yeah, I ended up in A&E, just like, not as in, I went in because I thought, look, I've taken tablets, and kind of at the time felt like I was being lectured by those around me. So
let me get a tissue. Yeah, take a second.
Because I'll end up drowning on the floor.
I know, hang on, let me get a tissue. Hang on. Take your time. I usually have some tissues.
I can't believe this is going on YouTube.
Give you a second to...
You're grand. It's like a therapy session, this.
No, give me a second. To get yourself back.
Yeah, the last thing you want is a snivelling mess for the whole thing.
No, we all need a minute sometimes, so don't
End
worry
scene.
About it.
Anyway, grand there. Rebecca kicked me under the table and I started crying. But yeah, no, I didn't get the help. I also didn't really look for the help, and I wasn't open to it if it was there, you know? So it took many years before I did go and see a counsellor. I went to see a psychotherapist. I went on antidepressants for a while. It was... Yeah, you're depressed. Yeah, you're this, or you're nothing. You're just a bit blue, whatever. Off you go. My emphasis was always on the low moods. So I guess I never noticed when I was a little high. So I just...
Running on adrenaline, maybe. Yeah. You're doing all those gigs. So
I'd be thinking, look, this is just me. This is me happy. This is me wired. Yeah, I'm up all night. I've decided to clean the house top to bottom at 4 a.m. So what? That's totally normal. Like talking 90 to the dozen, outlandish ideas, stopping people randomly on the street. That's one I know I still do now. When I'm a little hypomanic, I will stop somebody. I'll just start to talk to them. Want to talk to everyone I encounter. Hopefully they'll have dogs, because I love dogs.
Okay.
And that's generally what triggers it. It's like, oh, your dog.
Right.
So I can write it off as we're talking about the dog, but really I have energy, excess energy that I just need to do something with. But
Arlene, I'm going to stop the dishwasher. Hang on.
Okay.
I can hear it in the background.
I couldn't hear that.
Real insight into the house today.
Yeah.
Sorry, apologies. Go
on. Grand. I'll take a mouthful of tea.
Take yourself a minute, yeah.
The tea is very good in this establishment, might I just add.
Good. I love my tea. Tell me, you were saying that you just have to expel this energy and you do that by...
Yeah, I find that. Like, I'd get this idea, and maybe I should just kind of jump forward and then jump back.
Yeah, go for
to where I was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. I was 40, 41, 42, and I had said to myself, you know, I can't do this anymore. There's definitely something going on. It's more than just... I'm depressed. I'm also getting severely agitated when I'm wired. And I just went to my doctor and I said, look, I don't know, this is early menopause or what? Actually, I didn't think it was that. I didn't think it was that because it had been going on. The depression had been going on for so long. But I knew there was an issue. I wanted it resolved. So she referred me to a clinic and I saw a psychiatrist there. And for weeks and weeks of seeing these people, I went to see a few different doctors there and the clinical nurse, and they got me to keep a mood diary. So they would get me to jot down, because I suppose they were seeing things. I was presenting with this kind of list of things, and they were seeing, because they're the experts, something that maybe I wouldn't have been able to identify. So they got me to keep a mood diary. So it would be, okay, how many days are you feeling low, and how many days are you feeling where you've loads of energy and you're doing this, and what are you doing during this time, and what's the time frame between one and the other? And it was kind of hard to keep on top of as well at times, because when I'd be in great form, I'd be like, ah, sure, depression, that's gone, that's a distant memory now, you know, there's nothing, I'm grand, I'm great. In fact, I felt so great one day. I had this notion that I don't need my family members. It's like, sure, if I don't see them again, it's grand. I don't know what sense that made, no, like, made no sense at all, but I just had this notion that I was in such good form that I just didn't need anyone in my life, you know, even those closest to me. I went back to the clinic anyway, and at this point I had been doing my research because they had mentioned bipolar disorder, so I'd been doing a little reading up on things, and I was like, okay, I tick that box, that makes sense. And then they told me that that's what it was, that that's what was going on. Along the way, they had been trying to medicate me. And that was disastrous because it was either too much of an antidepressant. And then, okay, she's wired to the moon and that's not right. So let's hit her with an antipsychotic. And sure, like, I was floored. Like, I was like a walking zombie at times on that.
And were you in somewhere, like, you know what I mean? You had to go home and you were doing this at home.
Yeah, I was doing this at home. And my boyfriend now, at the time, of course, he was watching all this. And he would watch me get up in the middle of the night and I'd be whacked out of it on Seroquel, which is the antipsychotic. And I'd be nearly walking into the walls. And I wouldn't be right for half the next day, nearly, at times. It was very trial and error. And I'm glad now that I'm over that hurdle with it, you know. They tried lithium and everything for me, and between like my weight gain, I was all over the place with meds. And then eventually when they finally settled on a diagnosis of bipolar 2, they said, okay, this is what we'll do now, we'll go forward with these meds. And thankfully there hasn't been an issue with the medication. I think I'm on a relatively enough even keel. But I recorded a podcast with a guy in Australia some months back, and it only came out recently, and I was listening to it and I was like, it's so long since we did this. We had this chat. I don't even know what we discussed, but I was very upbeat and I chatted away to him and I said, I have to tell you, I'm in a very low place right now, but I'm a master of disguise and I managed to hide it. And I was listening to this going, oh God. So that was probably April. And I've been pretty much okay since then. But I haven't been in the last week or so. Like, it was probably about a week ago, I was starting to get really agitated. And I don't see these things coming. I see neither one or the other. You think I'd be used to it by now. Mm. But all of a sudden, it's on top of me. And it's like you've been hitting the head with a mallet or something. It takes you down. But that's where it started. And I noticed the mood going lower and lower. And the last few days there, I was moping around the place. I was in the bed. I couldn't get up. I just thought to myself, look, am I, I've done so well, and now where am I at? It's been months of an even keel and speaking out about mental health to people. And I will say that, and I will continue to say to people that anyone that has any sort of issues need to speak out. But, like, the way I've been over the last few days, to be honest, Rebecca, I was kind of worried about myself, and I'm worried about other people. I contacted my GP last week, and I said I had a problem with my back. And, again, I know I had a problem with my back, but my mood, I think, wasn't in a great place. Mm. And she wouldn't see me. She was like, well, you need to go for a COVID test. I said, okay, well, like, I have a pain in my back. I have no symptoms of COVID. I know that they try to play safe. But, yeah, she wouldn't see me. So that was fine. I rang the clinic yesterday that I had attended because, A, I needed a repeat prescription. I'm running low on my antidepressants and antipsychotics. And when I spoke to the girl there, I thought, well, look, when I get her on the phone, I'm just going to say, look, I don't have a follow-up appointment. I haven't heard from you in ages. I was last sent off with a prescription. And I wanted to say, look, I'm in a bit of a bad way and I don't know what I'm to do. Mm. She told me that they had no record of me in the clinic. Now, I have spoke very highly of them and my doctor and all the rest. And, you know, they're great people. And I understand this woman is obviously up to 90 with her job and it's stressful and whatnot. But to be told that there was no record of me. So, A, I haven't been able to speak to anybody. Two, I haven't got a prescription. And D, what happens next? I'm fearful for people, Rebecca, that are not maybe as strong-minded as I am. Because I am very strong, even though I can crumble very easily as a person. And then also when I'm depressed, I'm like a bag of, you know, pile of crap in the corner. I'm useless. But I do worry for people who are not as strong mentally that end up with those dips. And say, for example, somebody who wasn't strong-minded, couldn't get their doctor, rang a clinic looking for a repeat prescription or in the hopes of maybe speaking to somebody, and were told, sorry, we don't know. Are you with us? Or are you not with us? We don't have you on file. She couldn't put her hand to my chart. So I was like, okay, fine. There's no middle ground there from there. Because if I'm sent off with a follow-up appointment card, on the back it says, you know, in the case of an emergency, contact Lakeview in Nace Hospital. So that's a psychiatric unit. So am I to present myself at the door of a psychiatric unit, or am I to sit at home and be left to my own devices? Do you understand? It's like, I'm okay with that, and I'm okay now because I seem to have pulled myself, or I am pulling myself out of the funk. But what about people who can't? You know, that maybe feel, oh, like I'm not going to get somebody on the other end of the line. If I ring a clinic, I'm not going to be as dramatic as to go into the hospital and say, take me now, I don't know what to do with myself.
But is it dramatic? Is it?
No, it's not. But there'll be people out there who will feel like they're a burden, or they'll feel like their problems aren't great enough. Or, you know, for me, say, if I think back to food issues that I would have had, I could never put a title on it. Could I have called myself anorexic? Not really. I wouldn't have called myself bulimic because I wouldn't make myself sick. But I had an unhealthy relationship with food. I would deprive myself. I'd over-exercise. I couldn't put a title on that. So therefore, I felt I couldn't go to somebody and say, I'm an anorexic. Now, there's a label. Fix me, you know. So maybe there are people. Maybe I'm rambling now. I don't know.
But you're not, no. But I do. I would say to you in the moment that you're in right now is that, you know, it's your fight. It's your fight. And I know, and even I had a conversation with Beverly Coughlin today about mental health awareness and being advocates and stuff like that. But I think, first of all, when you're low and feeling the way you do, you just need to look after yourself. And if it means, because you've no support, you've no support right now, you've the GP, which is absolutely batshit crazy, that we have to have, like, Aria was sick. And she needed to have a COVID test before she could go in. And the doctor would see her and it was days. It's the system is so fucked up right now.
Yeah.
And absolutely for people who are struggling mentally, there's not enough help for people with eating disorders. There's not enough help. But when you're feeling the way you feel right now And you just need to look after number one and make sure that you're okay.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
Yeah.
You know, I know you're saying you're strong, but you, that's what you need to do.
Yeah. It kind of, look, I know I'm in a great place. And this
But why do you need to say that? Why do you need to say that? Because if you're struggling, you're struggling.
Yeah. Well, because I see it as a dip. Mm. You know, it's a speed bump or something along the way.
Yeah.
And I know that overall I'm in a good place. But I have to force myself. Like the things I had to do to actually try and make myself feel better. Like I was lying in bed, I was lying around for days. And surprisingly this low was very short in comparison. Overall it was probably about no more than 5 days. It can sometimes go on for 2 weeks, or it used to. But I woke up on, what day are we today, Tuesday? I woke up on Sunday and I said to my, no, it was yesterday, sorry, beg your pardon. I said to myself, look, I'm going to stay in bed all day. Then I said, no, do you know what? You're not going to do that because you have dogs downstairs that need to be let out. So just go as far as the kitchen.
Mm.
And if you do nothing after that, then isn't that progress?
Mm.
So I got to the kitchen and I made a coffee and I sat outside with it. And I said, okay, do you know what I'll do now? So I'll go upstairs and I'll have a shower and I'll clean the house and then I lie down and do nothing. But every time I say, look, just do that little bit, it seems like this massive, massive chore, massive effort had to be involved in doing anything. And then I get to a certain point and I listened to one of your podcasts as I was cleaning the house. And we discussed this earlier. I ended up sobbing my heart out because I listened to a girl's story and
Fiona.
It just floored me. My heart broke for her family, Keith, do you know, and I don't know what it is. I just found some sort of strength there. And when the podcast ended and my house was clean, I said, do you know what I'm going to do now? So I'm going to do a kettlebell workout in my kitchen. I'm going to do a kettlebell workout. And, you know, like I've done all the other things. So if I can do that, and all I kept saying was like, the last bloody thing I want to do is exercise now. I want to curl up in a ball. But I know I'm not going to feel any worse for having done it.
Mm.
So, those few things and pushing myself
to do it
seems to help.
Arlene, can I ask you, what is bipolar disorder?
So I have bipolar 2. Okay. So one, basically it's manic depression is what it was known as before. Okay. So it's the difference between bipolar 1 and 2 is 1 is more extreme. So the lows are incredibly low. The highs are at times so manic, a person can be just on a different planet, basically. And in a lot of cases, whether they're high or low, they can end up being committed to a psychiatric unit. Two is a lot more, how would we call it, a little watered down. Yeah. So again, I would get low, but not as low typically as somebody with bipolar 1. And then with the mania, it's hypomania. So it's not anything extreme. And again, thankfully, I have never needed to be hospitalized. I'm lucky like that. Although there's been times where I think, Jesus Christ, I wouldn't mind getting away from it all. Is there anyone willing to take me for a few days? I don't mean to make a joke of it, but like some sort of a retreat. I need to send myself away somewhere. But that's it. And it's not to make light of bipolar 2. And again, I'll just say I am no expert on the condition. I'm just going by what I've been told, how I feel, and you know, the hand I've been dealt.
Isn't Britney Spears, she has bipolar disorder, and that's how it became, not a buzzword, that's not right. Do you know what I'm trying to say? That's how it became, people start talking about it a little bit more when she shaved her head and attacked the car with the umbrella. It came out that she was bipolar.
To be fair on Britney, she wouldn't even need to be bipolar. The stuff that she's had to put up with, I don't know how that girl is still standing. You know, she's had a tough run of it. I think Kerry Katona, Catherine Zeta-Jones is bipolar. Mariah Carey, so
quite like it's and you know what the thing is, again, and I'm learning constantly, because some of the things we would say with the language, or if like you're saying something about someone, oh sure, she's bipolar, don't mind her, do you know what I mean? Again, it's just stuff,
it's a term,
we just have to be really careful about the words that we use now. Really, don't we?
Like, and I've heard that before, everyone's a little bit bipolar. I'm like, okay, that's that, like saying everyone has a little bit of cancer, you know? It just doesn't make any sense. But I know we say things, we like, we're conditioned to say certain things, and that's fine. Mm. You know, you can't be too politically correct either, you know, because you make allowances for people. We're not all perfect. But yeah, that's the situation.
Do you know what as well? I can't believe that when you're being trialed, when they're like experimenting on you with these medications, that you're at home doing this. It's bonkers to me. How long did that happen for? How long was it that over a period of time they were trialing you?
Again, I'm desperate when it comes to time, but it was definitely 6-8 months before they got the blend, shall we call it, right? And even at that, look, I'm assuming it's good. It's just I can't expect to have this and not occasionally hit dips. Again, as I said, it's progress in itself that it wasn't as lengthy as it was. I managed to pull myself out of it. It wasn't as extreme. I'm not as crazy as I used to be in terms of mania either. I mean,
what's the mania like? What does it do?
It's the best thing ever.
Is it?
Even though it isn't. It's at the time, it's like, okay, I have all these ideas and all these notions and I'm going to do this and do that. And it is brilliant, particularly in the line of work that I'm in. It's great to have that drive because you know yourself, you have to be a people person, you have to put yourself out there in the entertainment business. But yeah, it's exhausting as well, so I don't really sleep. So when I'm depressed, I'll sleep for Ireland, and when I'm wired to the moon, I'll get by on 2-3 hours sleep. My boyfriend will pick up on things and I won't know. He'll be like, there's something going on here. I'll be like, what's going on? Yeah, you're on the cusp of something. There's something brewing here. And I'd be like, okay, that explains why I was down on my hands and knees scrubbing the skirting boards and like running. Even I get this urge to run at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd be like, I need to go running. And there's a friend of mine, lovely girl. She also has bipolar. This is why we've managed to bond. She has told me the same thing. She gets the urge to run. So I don't know if it's a good thing. I think doctors told her before not to feed into it.
Okay.
But I think it'd be a great release to get up, put the runners on at 2 a.m. and go for a mad dash.
Yeah, but is it safe for you? You
no,
know,
of course not.
Thing.
Of course not.
And how has that, Arlene, manifested itself through your life? You know, did it affect your relationships? Obviously, it affected your marriage and so on. So will we go back a little bit and then talk to me about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It would have played a part in the, you know, demise of my relationships all the way along the line. I kind of had this thing for a long time, well, everybody leaves me. That sounds dramatic. I'm feeling sorry for myself, but I used to say that to Gordon, my boyfriend. Best of luck now, you know. It's going to be a bumpy ride with me because things are never normal. And even the last few days, I mean, I'm just a bit of a grump to be around. I should probably stop up and say, do you know what, go away and leave me alone for about 2 hours and let me just argue with myself in my head and come back to me then, and hopefully I'll be a nicer person, because I'm agitated a lot when I'm like that. So whether I'm up or down, it comes with a certain level of, you know, anxiety and whatever. I'm arguing with myself in my head, and then you take it out on the people around you. So yeah, of course there would have been issues. I know, like, over the years I wouldn't have confided in my family members about what was going on. They never found out up until recently about those two attempts that I made on my life. I think I would push them away a lot. When I'd start to feel down, I'd close down. I think maybe now my mother is seeing, okay, that's why she didn't come home for X amount of time, or this is why, you know, she didn't call as frequently when she was at home or whatever, you know. But the whole thing came to a head, Rebecca, to be honest, when my dad died. So this was it. Like, this was, I think, the bomb, the atomic bomb that went off. So, as I said, I'd gone past the 40 mark. I was already thinking to myself, look, you need to get things straightened out. And I'd say the most traumatic, I'll try not to cry again, but the most traumatic time of my life, I was doing a gig. It was for a private party, and I don't know, was it somebody's birthday? I think it was the 40th birthday party, and I was on stage. I had received a text from my older sister about an hour before I went on stage, and she said, what time did your gig finish at? I was like, well, normal time, whatever, you know, 11:30, 12:00. I thought it was strange that she was asking me that, because it wouldn't have been a time that she would have called to me afterwards. I knew there was something going on, so I thought, okay, well, sure, she'll tell me later or tomorrow.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I was halfway, 3/4 way through the gig. I was singing an ABBA song. It was a real party environment. People were on the dance floor. And I looked out at the door and I saw my brother standing there. I was like, there's Eric. And instantly I went, oh, there's Eric. That doesn't make sense. Why is he here? This is a private party. So I knew there was something going on. I was on stage, I'm singing. Who knows what I was spewing out. Like, the words were probably coming out in German. For all I knew, I was that shaken by the situation. I had a text. I had him standing at the end of the hall. And I knew there was some sort of bad news coming my way. So the song ended and I just went to the side of the stage and Eric was there. And he looked at me and he said, Daddy's gone. And I was like, what? Like, we're still playing. We're in the middle of a gig here. You know, what's going on? Completely and utterly out of the blue. My father wasn't sick. He, you know, we didn't have any time to get our heads around this. He had literally, now look, there had been warning signs. Again, we've a family history of heart problems on his side. And a number of months beforehand, he'd said he'd felt unwell, went to the doctor. And the doctor said, look, you've had a stroke. You've had a mini stroke somewhere along the line. That's your wake-up call now, to cop onto yourself. I actually remember going to my dad, making an appointment with the doctor, pulling up outside the house and nearly grabbing him by the scruff of the neck to get into the car. I've made a doctor's appointment for you now and you said you weren't feeling well. What are you talking about? Typical stubborn man. He wouldn't go to the doctor. He went a week later. That's when he was told about the stroke. And I kind of felt myself going, told you so, you know.
As you do.
But look, he was one of those people that would rather sweep everything under the carpet when it came to health for fear that he was going to be told something bad. So it was a case of, I'll just leave everything. And if I'm feeling this pain or unwell in some way, shape or form, sure, I'll just get on with it, say nothing until the day I die, you know, for fear that I'm told you have to be bedridden for 6 months with some sort of, you know, illness. My father would, he said himself, he watched his brother-in-law die from a brain tumour. And he said to my mum, look, if that ever happens to me, like, put a bullet in my head.
As so many people say, it's crazy how many men and women now saying it. I've heard from women as well, just don't leave me like that. Don't leave me like that.
Yeah.
So what did you do that night?
I was kind of surprised at my reaction. Like, I wasn't, I was very calm, but I was very put out, Rebecca. I was like, this isn't what we had planned for. No, I know this sounds ridiculous. I went into Nace Hospital and I was just, I had a big pissed off face on me. I was like, no.
Did you leave the gig straight away?
I literally turned to Gordon, my boyfriend who plays with me, and I said, look, Daddy's dead. And I remember him looking like he wanted to pick the guitar up and just fling it across the room. He was so stunned. Again, it was like, it was just, he was there. He was out for dinner with my mom and my sister and my brother-in-law. And a couple of hours later, he was dead, you know. So it was, it was just unexpected. By the time I got to the hospital, everyone was there. His brothers, my sisters, my brother actually and his wife brought me to the hospital. And again, I walked in, I saw him lying in the bed and I was like, he was still, I think, he seemed warm at that point. I was like, what the hell? So surreal, you know. I turned around, I looked in the mirror, and I was washing my face, and because my stage makeup was all over the place, and I'm there in like some sort of a stupid looking glitzy dress, just like disco diva, and everyone else is standing in the hospital room around a dead body. It's like, no, just so, this is what I say to people, it's like, you could worry about somebody, you could worry about your grandparents or, you know, whoever, somebody that's vulnerable or sick or whatever in your family, and you're constantly thinking, oh, I hope they're going to be okay. But it's the person that you're not expecting on the day you least expect it. It's the phone call on a random Tuesday. It's the, as I said, in the middle of a gig. I mean, like, what were the chances that I would be up on stage after all those years that Daddy pushed me literally onto the stage to sing with bands? Why was I told then, you know, and I don't know, I just had so many questions around the whole thing. But that was it. That was the, as I said, the bomb that went off. And with that, like, yeah, I decided I have to sort myself out. I think somewhere along the line after that, I may have lost the plot. I do remember every anniversary, of course, is terrible, but the 1 year anniversary being curled up, I was like, oh, like in an absolute catastrophic heap in the sitting room. And I said, no, I have to. I know that antidepressants don't solve all your problems. They don't cure grief. You have to go through that. But when there was other problems going on, and whether it was my heart or my head, I took it as, you know, as a sign that, look, there's somebody who didn't take responsibility for his health. Well, I'm going to take responsibility for mine going forward, and I'm going to live as healthy and as happy a life as I can, you know, from that point on. Do you know, I got my heart checked out, I got my head checked out, I got everything checked out, because, and we're very much like that now as a family, we speak out about things when there's something going on, particularly me and my older sister, we talk about everything because we don't want to do that whole head in the sand kind of thing. If my father had took his head out of the sand, he could be with us now, you know. So yeah, I think that was a major turning point. And again, it probably really, I think it pushed me over the edge as well, to a point that I thought, I'm not going any further. I have to seek help now.
Did you lose your mind with it? Like,
For a long time after he was gone, I found myself saying, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be alive. I knew I wasn't saying I want to kill myself, but I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be here anymore. And I used to have this, I don't know if you're like this, but the terrible fear of death. You know, I used to have nightmares about it. I'd be thinking, oh my God, it sounds ridiculous. How does anyone go through that? And you have to go through it on your own. And what's it going to feel like? And is it going to hurt? And all these thoughts. And I just thought, I've no fear anymore of death, because if there's anything on the other side and he's there, you know, I'll be grand. But no, it's funny, isn't it, when time goes on and you've lost somebody so close to you, you eventually stop thinking of them first thing in the morning. You know, you do. He's no longer my first suffocating thought when I get up. And that's brilliant. That's great that I'm, you know, you don't get over it, but you get on with it. And that's it. In one way, I'm kind of, I'm glad that I'm speaking out about stuff and he's not here to listen, because I don't know if he'd know what to do with it.
You know, I don't know if that sounds a bit
silly
point to make, but yeah.
Because he'd probably feel like he let you down.
Maybe, yeah, the whole protective dad thing, that he should have been there for this, that and the other, but like, you know.
He was never going to be, because you never spoke about it.
I never spoke about it, you know, more fool me. I haven't shut up about it in the last while.
That's good.
Yeah. Of course, my mother picked up a very well-known magazine there recently and read a story about me. Things she never knew, things that I didn't get to talk to her about before the article came out, and things that I still haven't talked to her about. So we've yet to have a big kind of heart-to-heart talk.
Why do you think you haven't spoke to her about it?
Since? I suppose I haven't really seen her that much. She was away. She was in Portugal with my brother. He lives over there. And
that's not an excuse.
No, it's not. I know.
You know.
I've avoided her. That's, And I called around this evening and she had a thumping headache, and I kind of thought, yes, we don't have to talk about this right now.
Did she ring you when she read it? Did she ring you?
She did, yeah, she did.
What did she say
to you? And I was quick to say to her, Ma, look, I'm in a great place now. This is why I'm able to talk. Again, I know maybe I'm contradicting that after saying, you know, that I've been in a bit of a low mood the last few days, but overall, I'm, you know, on the right track. I'm medicated. When I can get the right people on the phone and they can find my bloody file, I can talk to people, you know. I've been to counsellors and stuff, and I've talked through things. So I wanted her to be aware that I can't go back if I've spoken out. I can't keep these things a secret anymore. And once it's out there, I'm forced now to address it. I have to address it. And I think when it happens again, and if I feel that low, yeah, I'm going to take myself to the hospital if I have to, and just say, look, right, I need help.
It's your only option. You need to just do it and just
If my leg was broken, well, you know, I'd have to go to the hospital. There's something not right. And that's what I say to people. Just try your best, even if it's to pick up the phone and ring somebody that you don't know, some sort of a, like the Samaritans or somebody like that. I don't know. There's a lot of options out there. There is, and we have to take responsibility for ourselves, and
that's a big thing.
Yeah,
you have to take responsibility for yourself.
Yeah, you do.
That's a big thing.
Yeah,
I don't think people do.
No, a lot of people are too busy looking after other people and forgetting about their own well-being. And you know, what is it they say about if you don't make time for your health, you'll have to make time for your illness, whatever it might be. You know, you just have to address whatever it is. And I guess, yeah, my dad taught me that life is short. He died at 69. You know, it was too young. And why would you go through life, you know, making things difficult on yourself if there was a way that you could see to make it easier? So, you know, whether that's antidepressants, whether that's talking to somebody, whether it's running your arse off in the gym to release endorphins, whatever it might be, to alleviate the problem. It's best to just own it. And well, it was for me anyway.
And the magazine, what was it? It was RSVP?
No, it was Life magazine with the Sunday Independent.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. No offense to RSVP.
Yeah, well, no, I was in that too.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, they did a big story. It was great. It was a lovely platform, you know, to be given. But
what was the biggest thing in the article that you're afraid or worried about your mum seeing?
Taking an overdose at 15, because for her as a parent, I would imagine in her head, which is not the case, but I'd say she probably feels like she let me down. She didn't let me down at all. She was completely oblivious. In fact, I remember the day after, because I was quite sick that night, and I was sick throughout the next day, and I was at home curled up in the armchair. And I remember her saying to me, "Now I'm going to ask you something, and look, you're not going to get in trouble. I just want to ask you." And I said, "What?" She said, "Are you pregnant?" Because I was just being so sick. I was like, no. Like, I mean, I hadn't even been with anyone at that point. Like, get away from me. No, I suppose that was probably the biggest thing. And there's nothing else I'm holding on to, Rebecca. That's the thing. Like, I'm now, I'm not afraid anymore. I'm not afraid to be me. I'm not afraid to speak out. I don't care, you know. There's nobody I'm afraid of. There's nothing there that I have hidden in the closet that I'm worried that someone's going to find out. Like, I've owned my story, and I'm just, yeah. And I think if my mother's okay with it, with things, once we get her kind of all right with, yeah, or her head around certain things, and she understands that I'm here and I'm for the most part happy and whatnot, then I don't care. I don't care about anything else. I'll continue to speak, and I'll continue to, as long as I don't let myself down as well, you know, that I...
Why do you think you'd let yourself down?
Oh, I always had this thing that, like, you know, when you get kind of scolded by your parents, it's like if they're disappointed in you. That's I thought that was the worst feeling ever. I'd rather, like, they ate the head off me for something, but to hear that they were disappointed in me always kind of stuck with me. So I think that's the thing. I want to kind of carry myself and tell my story and just not let myself down and hopefully help other people, you know.
And it will.
Yeah, here's hoping. I actually, yesterday morning, I thought to myself, how am I going to come up to this woman's house and sit in front of her and talk? How am I going to actually get in the car and get there? Someone's going to have to bring me. Like, I'm going to have to be carried there and put in front of this woman, and I'm not going to be able to say anything to you. And it just comes out. I think the reason I started crying here is because this face-to-face thing, it's like a therapy session. God damn you. You have some sort of a knack, you know.
I'm told that all the time. Yeah. I was away even the weekend, and I was like, and they were like, Rebecca, please don't podcast me, please. Yeah. And I was like, I won't, I'm walking away. take it back to me for about being in the industry. That must have been a really, not scary, because you probably didn't realise it was scary because you're manic. But more the pressure and the stress in that industry to remain relevant even when you left the band, and as you get older, as an older woman in her 40s,
yeah,
to stay relevant in that game, it must be very difficult.
Oh, of course it is. You know how hard it is to be a woman anyway. Mm. At the best of times, you're worried about, what was it, I heard Deirdre O'Kane say, she doesn't mind getting older, but she's worried about her face hitting the floor or falling into the sea. We have our own set of concerns, you know, and appearance is one of them, because, like, in the entertainment industry, yeah, you have to look a certain way. I suppose when you don't have to look a certain way, but there was pressure on me.
Mm.
And when I was younger, I would have been subjected to comments from people in an audience at times, you know, you're the fattest one in the band. Like, I was tiny, size 8 at the time. I was a straight up and down teenager. You know, you'd be subjected, you put yourself up there and out there for people to scrutinize, and I can only imagine how difficult it is for well-known celebrities who are on the front pages of magazines. Look at the weight she's put on, look at the weight she's lost, look at her stuff in her face, look at her, you know, look at her there with no makeup on. So I felt that because, as I said, like, I would wear, at the time, skimpy outfits on stage, so you are being watched head to toe. And
what did you think of Little Mix? My dad rang me and he said to me, you need to sit down with the girls. And I said, and he said, watch this program. He said, it's a girl, she was in a band, her name is Jessie, and she's from, he said, Little Something, you know. And yeah, he didn't know who she was, he just seen the documentary. And he said, by God, Rebecca, he said, that scared the living life out of me, the fact that the abuse she was getting and how she felt, and even her own band members were apparently part of that as well.
Right. The only thing that got me with them, and I know very little about her story, I have seen clips and stuff, but I sound like an owl one here, but like the overly sexualized look that those girls would have in videos and on stage, I don't know if it's good for them. Who's actually promoting that, and why are they subjecting it on young kids? I don't know. That's just my opinion. I kind of think, and that's veering off somewhere else there, but I don't know. Yeah, look, it's desperate for that girl if she was subjected to stuff like that. She's there half naked, whether it was her weight or her face or whatever it was. These trolls latch onto things. And, you know, as I said, I feel very sorry, desperately sorry for girls that are women that are subjected to that on a more public scale. Like, I've got it private message to me. I've been called every name under the sun. I've been sent dick pics. It's like, you know, sure you're there and, you know.
What is that like to get a dick pic? I never got one.
It's wonderful, Rebecca. You know,
I've never had one. Thank God. Don't send me any thanks.
What do they want me to do? Like, print it out and shove it up my... Like, what the hell? You know, it's like, thanks. Mm. It's not attractive to look at ever. Mm. And, yeah, jog on there. No, that's eased off a lot now. The last little while, thank God, the joys of not being single.
How did you meet Gordon?
How did I meet Gordon? He is a sound engineer and a guitar player, and we had moved in similar circles. And I remember I'd always known the name, and he was doing sound for me at a gig one time. There was a couple of different acts on, and I was late for the. I didn't make it to the sound check, so I literally ran in. And when it was time for me to go on stage, I went on, and he was there in the sound booth, and he was with another guy, a friend of his, who also works does lights with him. And I thought, what's going on up there with the two of them? They look like they're having great crack. So in the theatre that night, I had got up and I'd done a couple of songs, and there was a few other set of acts performing that night. So I sat down with a couple of guys that I'm friends with, and everyone was facing the stage. But I kept looking around. It's like, what's going on back there? I was so drawn to him. I just kept looking back. If anyone had seen, like... whatever number of hundred people staring at the stage and one person with their head turned around staring at the guy in the sound booth. But that was that. We didn't cross paths for a while then. We ended up doing some Christmas shows together. So there was a band that wanted a female singer just for their Christmas shows in December. And I wasn't really in the habit of doing this whole depping thing. I didn't really enjoy it, but I just thought, you know, whatever, sure... Gordon Turner's in the band and he's meant to be great crack, so I'll get to know him. And I did. I had good fun with him. I found him really easy going. He worked with other singers at the time, and he said to me one time, you know, I do this two-piece act, and he went out by himself occasionally and with other bands and sound gigs and whatnot, and he said, like, I'll work with this girl. She'll come from Dublin, and then there might be other gigs that are kind of Carlow based, and this other singer will accompany me then. And I said, would you just give me all the work? And he was like, yeah, okay. And it went from there, and we started gigging, and we became really, really good friends. And I think that was the basis. That's a real kind of basis for a strong relationship, to have that. To have that friendship, to have the crack. Like, he is most definitely my best friend. Like, we laugh at the stupidest of things, and we've the same ridiculous sense of humor. But again, he has the patience of a saint, because he has seen me unmedicated. He has seen me on the floor. He's seen me like wired to the moon. He's seen me on the wrong kind of medication, and he's consistent, and he's there, and he hasn't let me down, and he's... It doesn't look like he's going anywhere anytime soon, which is brilliant, because all the rest fecked off, you know.
And that's really important, isn't it? Yeah. That he's seen you every which way.
Yeah, and he was there for me when Daddy died as well. Like, he really was by my side. You know, it was just brilliant. He's a great lad. And we formed the band. So it's rare to meet somebody who has... Well, I've never met anyone who has my interest at heart as much as he does. So in terms of moving forward musically, my interests are his interests and his interests are mine. And you know what I mean? We work really well. So,
do you know, you just like that said that, like, you know, so he had your interests at heart. It's really important to find someone.
Yeah.
Like that has your interests.
And so bloody rare.
Yeah.
Like, and to come out of a marriage as well and to go through divorce and... Like, to find somebody, so I don't mean this wrong, and Jesus, if he's listening to this, he'll be like, yeah, I'm deadly, haven't I? No, but he's so perfect for me. He's not perfect, and I'm not perfect, but we're perfect for one another. And we formed the band, and we decided, you know what, this is your baby, Arlene. Like, we'd done all these gigs where it would be pub gigs, and it would be weddings, and it would be funerals, and all sorts of shows and gigs and whatever. He helped form that band for me. he rounded up musicians, and musicians that were brilliant, and musicians that we could trust and work with. And he's the one that takes care of, like, sound and getting to gigs and equipment and all that. He's the brains behind the whole thing, you know. I'm the face and he's the arse, basically.
Say the same about my pal, but I wouldn't give him that much. You kill me after this. Tell me this. What was the big highlight in your life, and then what was one of the lowest points in your life, other than what you've already spoke to me about in your career even?
Highlights? I suppose one of the greatest moments of my life was in the first time I went to Nashville. I recorded an album there.
Wow.
And that was grand. That was fine. It was a small scale kind of situation. But I went a second time and recorded a second album. And this time I had a serious lineup of musicians. Like, it was a bit kind of, first time round, it was kind of in the back of a garage, sort of a recording setup. But hey, we could stick a Nashville label on some of the songs. Some of the album was recorded in the UK as well. But anyway, the second album was exclusively recorded in Nashville. And I had musicians with me that were, like, the guy that produced the album was Willie Nelson's keyboard player.
Okay.
A guy that played guitar worked with Keith Urban. Somebody else had written songs for huge names. Like, we're talking, like, I sat there with my mouth open. I felt like, you know, who am I? Like, small town girl, you know what I mean? Sitting amongst these people that were just, you know, just amazing when it came to music. And they had a totally different setup there as well compared to, like, the way we record here and the way we record in the UK and whatever. It's all number based out there, and it's just play the song there. Like, I brought the song Carrick Fergus out to them, the Irish song, and they'd never heard it, and they were like, okay, that's nice. And then they turned it into some big, I don't know what, massive production with fiddles and pedal steel, and I sat there in awe, and every 5 minutes I was up and down and out to ring my mother. I mean, like, I can't believe this. Like, I can't believe that I'm in, like, to other people this may sound ridiculous, but because they were kind of the royalty of musicians, as far as I could see, in Nashville, you know, so you're not going to get any better than somebody who played keyboards for Willie Nelson. Absolutely. That's playing keyboards for me on my album. So I kept going out and ringing her, going, like, pinch me. This is just amazing. Like, it was amazing. Probably one of the lowest points that I remember then, just while you ask that, would be jumping back now a few years when my ex-husband and I, as I said, we were engaged for a period of time and then we broke up. And one thing led to another, and I found myself standing outside my mother and father's house because I had to leave his house with all my stuff in black bags, because I may have had a suitcase, but everything else was in black bags. And I stood at the door with my mother, and it was New Year's Eve. And I just said to her, like, this is nearly laughable. Like, this can't get any worse. I'm now, well, not homeless, because I always had my mum and dad's to go to if I needed to. And I had some sort of a base in the UK. But I was standing there going, on New Year's Eve, when I thought I had all this ahead of me, this amazing future and this wedding booked, and this has gone tits up, pardon my French. And I went to Belfast, I drove to Belfast, and I got on a ferry to Scotland, and I played that night, New Year's Eve, and I remember singing stupid things like I Will Survive, and, like, nearly snotting and bawling through the whole thing, singing Auld Lang Syne, going, there goes that year. What's ahead of me the next year? Like, and I got my SIM card out of my phone and I just flung it out the window as I actually was on the way when I was driving to Belfast. And they didn't hear from me for 3 months. I didn't come home. 4 months, maybe. I couldn't cope. I was like, what the hell? Like, my life just took a total about turn. And in one way, I could see the humour in it. As I said, when I stood there with everything in black bags going, like, the last day of whatever year it was, going, like, what the hell?
And why did the relationship break down? Was it your illness or?
It was, I try to be diplomatic about this. I suppose, as I said to the girl that interviewed me for Life magazine, I had my problems and he had his. So together, like, it wasn't even though we were madly in love with one another, you know, and I did see a future with him. I had hoped that that's where it was going to go, but it didn't. And ultimately, we were probably better off away from one another, you know, which was sad, but...
And when you got your diagnosis, did you reach out to him?
No, I didn't. I closed that door a long time ago, and I suppose there had been a couple of attempts along the way, maybe where he tried to reach out to me and I tried to reach, but it was never right. I think we were, the only time I actually tried to reach out to him was to try and sort out our divorce. So that was it. But look, do you know, I wish the lad all the best in the world, and I'm hoping that he's doing well. And, you know, I don't know the person anymore. It's funny, you know, it's like, as the song goes, now you're just somebody that I used to know. It's just one of those things and one of those times in your life, and people get together and sometimes it doesn't work out. Nobody's died. It happens. And I'm so grateful that I have such a healthy relationship now, you know, that I can kind of just, and I think, you know, you're over somebody when you can actually, when you don't feel any, you don't hold grudges, and you just think best of luck with whatever you do, you know.
And when you did the Life magazine piece, was there any negativity at all from any family members or friends?
No. Not at all. I found it strange, though. I started to nearly feel uncomfortable with all the people saying I was so brave, because I was like, I didn't quite get it. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it. And look, I suppose I was brave. I was. Mm-hmm. But I guess I wanted people to read it, but I kind of didn't really want anyone to say much to me about it, other than to celebrate the fact that it was a bit of publicity and it was hopefully something that would help other people. So I kind of didn't really want to attract all that much attention with it. I kind of wanted other people to take a look and say, okay, maybe a family member of mine, you know, is unwell and I see similarities, or somebody else is reading it going, yeah, I need to get help. There's help out there. I need to go look for it. I was just genuinely hoping to help other people. Maybe in my own little selfish way, it was a bit of therapy for me, you know, like this is. I'll go home tonight now and I'll feel like I've been steamrolled, because I will feel like I've had a therapy session, because it can be exhausting to talk, but in another sense, it's great. It's great to let it out.
You know? What are you going to do now? What are you going to do, Arlene?
what am I going to do? I'm focusing so much on my career, Rebecca. I'm with the new album out now. I'm, as I said, banging down doors. I'm getting a bit of publicity. I'm getting a bit of airplay. I can't, as much as I want to fly the flag for mental health and I want to speak out in the hopes that other people will seek help, I also can't forget that I'm a musician, I'm a singer, and that's what I'm really ultimately trying to promote, and that's where my heart really lies. I love to perform. We have a few gigs lined up. We've done a couple of theatre gigs there recently, government-funded ones, and we have some stuff in the pipeline, but for the minute, it's still very much up in the air. Nobody's really booking tours as such, and next year I think is going to be the year that we hopefully get a bit more clarification on things, and that we can say, okay, from a certain point now we're going to work to do this stint. And the aim is theatre gigs, even small venues, where, like, a show that we did recently was an acoustic show, and you have people in the palm of your hand, so it's so different than the full band, because the band is like, there's five of us. Yeah, five, to think about that. And it's loud and it's edgy country and it's tongue-in-cheek and we're having the crack and we're rocking out. But when you do an acoustic gig, I think I love one equally as much as the other. There's something lovely about sitting on a stool and having an audience in the palm of your hand. And it's just a guitar. Like the last time we had Gordon on guitar, and we had a female fiddle player. So, do you know, lovely. It was just lovely to do those kind of gigs, because you then get to do a different spin on your own songs and you get to talk to an audience and kind of engage with them a little bit more. And it's just, as long as I'm performing, Rebecca, and as long as, you know, I suppose I want to be a little bit precious about it and not kind of just do what I used to do and play everywhere and anywhere, because I think COVID has taught us a lot, you know. I suppose we've all had a chance to take a look at things and put things in perspective. But for me personally now, going forward, it's my own shows. It's not the play in the pubs and stuff like that. Mm. They're great mm. crack, and there's money to be made. But now I need to take a step back from that as self-preservation as well, because the years of being in that environment and being in pub environments since the age of four, really, since singing on stage in pubs, I think I need to kind of take me and go, no, you know, we're going to put you there now in a little bit more comfortable environment. And especially, as you said, like of an age now where I'm like, no, you know, if it's not for me, it's not happening. If it doesn't feel right, or I've done my apprenticeship in a sense, I guess, in that regard. So I'm like, no, I'll aim for those gigs and I'll pick and choose the gigs. And I'm finding it a little bit difficult right now to kind of break down the doors TV wise here, which is funny. Mm-hmm. You know, I found it easier in the UK to get TV spots and stuff. So not that that's been a deterrent for me. I'm still banging on those doors, you know. And as long as I'm performing, I'm happy. Once I figured out that, you know, after a bit of a break for a while between COVID and then a few other bits and pieces along the way where I said, look, I'll take a rest for a number of months, I always came back to this. And it is always what sat well with me and what's really what keeps me happy, you know, inside the music. And I think whether it's my music, whether it's exercise, whether it's my pets, I'm surrounding myself with the things that bring me joy as best I can, because, you know, there are external elements out there that'll come and get you and, you know, throw a cat among the pigeons. So I try to keep things as happy as possible.
The last question I'll ask you, what do you think has saved you over the years?
Me. Yeah, and I know that probably sounds a bit me. I remember being in an unhappy situation before in the past, and my sister said to me, my ex-husband at the time, he saved you. You know, like as in, he made you see the clearing for the trees, or he, whatever it was. And I thought, yeah, he did. But then I thought back, no, all those times where I did whatever or pulled myself out of a hole or whatever, it was me. It was me. Fair enough, I'm assisted by medication and, you know, a medical team and whatever else. And I've seen, as I said, excellent counsellors and therapists and whatnot to help me. But ultimately, it's been me who's got up off my backside and sought the help. You know, and all the way along the line, when things got tough, I guess I have a certain sense of resilience. And yeah, I put up a therapist actually that I spoke to one time, gave me this kind of trick. She was like, imagine like nearly a brick wall up in front of you. And then when certain people come with certain things to throw things at you, it's only going to get so far. So I kind of, at the time, I could see probably a bit morbid, but I envisioned it being like a headstone in front of me. Okay. Like, you know, and you try to throw something at a headstone. It's just, I don't know why that picture came to mind, but that's what I feel. I'm like, I'm looking after myself and I think maybe shielding myself from the crap that's out there. Still, well, as I said, get the crap. Still get the occasional penis picture or abusive message from somebody online. It's gas, isn't it, the internet, how it brings us all together in a wonderful way and in a messed up way as well, where people think they can just contact you and, you know,
and say what you want to say,
call you a piece of shit. Yeah,
I'll tell you, Eileen, I was away for work recently, and we had enhanced events, enhanced entertainment, and Lulu was one of the ones that we had on board, It was very emotional for us, because it's the first time seeing live, live entertainment, live acts. And for you guys, I can only imagine what it's like. But when we were leaving the ship, I said to her, I was escorting her off, and I said to her, Lulu, look up. And everyone was on their balconies and they were waving to her, and she burst into tears.
Oh.
And she said to me, Rebecca, I'm 72 years of age. She said, and I don't have much of that left. She says, after all these years and this year, 18 months of not working and seeing that, she was like, I love it. And she just walked the whole length of the pier and waved to every single one of them. And it was such a magical moment for me that I was like, this is Lulu. Like, you know what I mean?
Exactly. And for such a legend, you probably would think moments like that are a dime a dozen to somebody like that, but you still obviously are so grateful. And of course, like every musician, whether they're, you know, doing small gigs, big gigs, whatever, they've missed it. And you're in that industry for a reason, you know, and I guess she is, you know, she, that's where her heart lies. That woman has been singing since she's very young. Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Fair play to her. She does not look 72.
Yeah. She's graceful 72. Well, Arlene, thank you so much for coming here. And do you know what? Even more so because you've been feeling so low. So thank you for like having the strength. And as you said, the resilience that you have, and you are saving yourself to come here tonight to my home to talk to me. I thoroughly enjoy this. So thank you so much.
Me too, despite all the crying. That's okay. But look, you obviously have that knack.
That's okay.
Maybe you've missed your calling, Rebecca. You should have been a counsellor or something.
I don't know. I have my cruise calling is the one that the ocean calls me.
Yeah.
And that's where I am.
Well, look, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And as I said, welcome me into your home. And like, again, it's another step in the right direction for me, you know, just to be able to voice it. And again, hopefully maybe if there's someone listening and they feel like they need some sort of help, just speak out. That's what I want to say to people, you know.
Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.